Traditionally, there are 613 commandments in the Torah. You probably know 10 of them. So which is the most important? Thou shalt not kill seems pretty important, but, and no offense, I just picked one sort of at random, thou shalt not touch a dead rat seems pretty trivial. That's Leviticus 11:29. Even among the most important commandments, though, it's an interesting question. Is it most important that a Jewish man be circumcised? Or is it more important that we keep the Sabbath? Are the religious rites, like holy days and sacrifices, the most important? Or are legal commandments, like not stealing, more important? Or are ethical commandments, like giving to charity, the most important? So imagine the fight that you might get into if someone asked you, as a Unitarian Universalist, which of the seven principles is the most important? Let's start a fight right now. Who thinks the first is the most important? Okay, don't do it. Robert's going to be team captain for principle one. Raina, you want to take principle seven? Okay, we'll battle it out in the yard afterwards. So in Jesus' time, according to the way that this story is told in the Gospels, people who resented Jesus' growing influence were constantly trying to find ways to sabotage him. And one strategy that they used was to ask him difficult questions that would trap him into offending somebody, whichever way he answered. But Jesus always found a creative way to answer that got him out of the trap. For instance, they asked him, should we pay our taxes when we know that Rome, will use the money to support programs that violate our principles? And Jesus answered, whose picture is that on the back of the coin? Well, give to Caesar what is Caesar's and give to God what is God's. They asked him a question about a woman who married a man who had six brothers. And one by one, each of the men died. And each time the woman married another one of the brothers until eventually she had married all seven of them. So in heaven, they ask, who is she married to? And Jesus answered, angels don't get married. So having heard Jesus respond to these questions, one more guy comes up and he tries one more question. And here's the story according to the Gospel of Mark. One of the teachers of the law came and heard them debating. Noticing that Jesus gave them good answers, he asked him, of all of the commandments, which one is the most important? The most important one, answered Jesus, is this. Hear, O Israel, the Lord our God, the Lord is one. Love the Lord your God with all your heart and with all your soul and with all your mind, and with all your strength. The second is this, love your neighbor as yourself. There is no commandment greater than these. Matthew and Luke, two of the other gospel writers, tell the same story. And in Matthew, Jesus adds the phrase, all of the law and the prophets hang on these two commandments. So Jesus avoids the trap. He finds a commandment, or two commandments actually, that he says encompass all of the others. Hear, O Israel, the Lord our God, the Lord is one. Love the Lord, your God, with all your heart and with all your soul and with all your mind and with all your strength. Which is a quote from Deuteronomy 6. The first part of that is called the Shema, which observant Jews repeat twice a day during morning and evening prayers. Shema Israel, Adonai Eloheinu, Adonai Echad. Love your neighbor as yourself, Jesus quotes from Leviticus 19. So Christians call this commandment of Jesus the double love commandment. Love God with all your heart, soul, mind, and strength, and love your neighbor as yourself. It's really a triple love commandment, though, because you're commanded to love three things, God, your neighbor, and yourself. Now, to say that all of the law and the prophets is included in a single commandment to love God, neighbor, and self, Jesus must mean love not the almighty person of God, but rather love the collection of universal values which the word God represents. It's a commandment that we can follow regardless of our theology. Love the ethical principles of order and family and reciprocity and fairness and kindness, forbearance, forgiveness, charity, and so on, which all of those 613 commandments derive from. Love unrestrained without hate or enmity, as the Buddha says. Let your life be led by love for yourself and your neighbor and by the most expansive kind of love that you can feel. Love with all of your heart, soul, mind, and strength so that the entirety of your life becomes firmly and squarely aligned with love-filled living. Ethical living is not merely thinking good thoughts divorced from action. Ethical living is not merely practicing a series of ritual behaviors divorced from understanding. Ethical living is not performing good deeds but with contempt in your heart. Ethical living is not following commandments because they are written in a book, but rather because they are written in your soul. So the commandment is not love. The commandment is love with all your heart, all your soul, all your mind, and all your strength. To be well, to create a healthy life, all four components of ourselves must be attended to. Wellness of the mind, a life that aligns with our values, and a well-organized life that plans ahead and focuses on the meaningful things rather than simply the most urgent things. Wellness of the heart. We feel our emotions fully, but we don't let our emotions overwhelm us. We enjoy relationships that encourage the free expression of our authentic selves, but also holds us in nurturing connections based on mutual responsibility and accountability to others. Wellness of the soul. We follow a holistic, ecstatic, and intentional spiritual practice, and we belong to a spiritual community, such as this one. We looked at those three over the last 2 weeks, if you've been here. And today, I want to pick up the other aspect of wellness of the soul that has to do with rest and play, and then look as well at wellness of the body, the fourth of the four. All your heart, all your soul, all your mind, and all your strength. The Reverend Dr. Scott Stoner, whose work he calls the Living Compass, I've been relying on for this sermon series, puts rest and play under the compass point of wellness of the soul. I talked a few months ago, actually, about the importance of Sabbath, that in any period of work, a portion should be set aside for rest and play. 5 to 10 minutes out of every hour during your workday, 1 or 2 days out of every week, a 3-day weekend out of every month, a month out of every year, if you can get one. I like to consider July to be the Sabbath month for the Unitarian Universalist Church here. Studies show that the average American only took about half of the vacation time that they earned in the previous year. A study a few years ago concluded that lack of sleep is as bad for our physical health as is smoking. Lack of sleep increases risk of heart disease and diabetes and causes short-term mental health impairment equivalent to being drunk. Leading neurologists tell us all, go back to bed. And here's what Dr. Stoner says. The biggest deficit in many people's lives right now is not money, but time. Telling people how busy you are has become a badge of honor in our culture. We are moving so fast at times that we forget how important rest and play are to our wholeness. And here are some questions to help you assess your satisfaction with this aspect of your life. How often do you play? What were the attitudes of your family of origin about playing? How do you play? Do you play with others? Whom do you play with? Do you take time to recreate every week or weekend? Do you take all of your vacation? And do you truly recreate while you're on vacation, or are you checking in on your iPhone? Do you have hobbies that you enjoy? And do you get enough sleep on a regular basis? Under the category of wellness of the body, Dr. Stoner isn't talking about strength in terms of how many pounds you can lift, but strength in terms of resilience. When something challenging comes up in your life, how quickly are you able to bounce back from the stress? We think about stress as though it's an emotion that is caused by stressful situations. But stress resilience isn't under wellness of the heart, it's under wellness of the body. Because stress is not an emotion, it's a collection of physical symptoms. And then the good news is that stress is a physical response to situations, so it's a response that we have some power over and can learn to control. When I get stressed, I get a rash that shows up across my belly and back. And in fact, sometimes it's seeing that rash that is my first signal that I'm actually feeling stressed, and then I can take care of myself. Other stress symptoms that people have could be headaches or chronic pain, meaning pain that's not tied to a specific incident or an injury, getting sick easily because your immune system is weak, insomnia at night or fatigue during the day. Some people lose their appetite when they feel stress. That's me. And other people overeat when they feel stress. Rapid heartbeat or shortness of breath that can feel almost like a heart attack. And stress can also result in feeling short of temper or unusual irritability with others and misdirected anger. So how should we respond to stress when we feel it or prepare ourselves for stressful situations that we know are coming up? Well, physical exercise is crucial. Going to the gym is part of my spiritual practice, and going hiking when I have a few days off. Go to the doctor for your regular checkups. Go to the dentist for your regular cleanings. Eating well, of course, which means both more of the nutritious stuff and less of the junk. Also, notice why you eat. Are you eating because you're hungry, or are you eating because it's a stress response? For the first 200,000 years or so of human existence, our species faced the problem of too few calories and too little information. For the last 50 years or so, the problem is too many calories and too much information, and we're still adapting. Turn off the phone, close the laptop, turn off the TV, go to bed. Most people need 7 to 9 hours every night. I'm a 9-hour guy. The church has been a stressful place for many of us in the last year or so. The death last summer of your previous director of music, Alan Lefoe. The sudden resignation a year ago of your previous minister, Mitra Ranama, immediately following her return from sabbatical. The circumstances of that resignation added to the stress that would have been felt in any loss. Resignation also of your previous office administrator a year ago, and our director of lifespan religious education, who resigned in March. We said a grateful but also a reluctant goodbye to our retiring membership coordinator in May. The personnel committee and I made some decisions about the music positions at the church that resulted in saying further goodbyes to our previous music staff in June. The worship committee and I, mostly me, introduced several changes to our standard liturgy and our order of service that I know have not been welcomed by all of you. Earlier this year, the congregation was forced to respond to the disturbing behavior of a church member, repeated instances of behavior that most of us considered beyond the acceptable boundaries of a church community. Unfortunately, the board's action to suspend the church member failed to encourage her to address her behavior and instead resulted in several weeks of increasing harassment of the church. Most of us felt weeks of anxiety, torn between sympathy for a woman who was clearly suffering and the need to care for the institution of our church and the safety of church members and staff who felt threatened. And then, just this last June, to add one more stressor to this list, a water pipe burst in the church office, flooded the back of the office, and for 2 months now, staff has been working out of a disrupted office while church volunteers have spent numerous hours dealing with insurance, making office redesign decisions, and interviewing contractors. It's not unusual that you might be feeling symptoms of stress, and I'm sorry. And I'm sorry, I can't say it's going to ease up anytime soon, because nearly all of those situations that I listed still require some response from the church. Those stresses are not only behind us, they are still ahead of us. We have practical work to do, for instance, about repairing the church office. We have grief and mourning work still to do around the several losses that we've experienced. And we have work to do of forgiving each other and rebuilding trust within our community. And we have new work to do as well, new business of the church year around issues of governance, leadership, mission, communications policies, every other policy, planning for district assembly, and preparing you for your search for a new settled minister. So, let us not pray to be sheltered from dangers, but to be fearless in facing them, as Rabindranath Tagore says. Not beg for the stilling of pain, but for the heart to conquer it, to be our own strength. Gathered here in one strong body. Blessed Spirit of my life, give me strength through stress and strife. Help me live with dignity. Let me know serenity. Fill me with a vision. Clear my mind of fear and confusion. When my thoughts flow restlessly, let peace find a home in me. May it be so.